Before we start, I want to tell you about another podcast I'm enjoying, Face Off, United States versus China. It's about how the two nations, once friends, are now foes, and why things are so complicated now. The host, Jane Perlez, was Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. On Face Off, she talks with diplomats, spies, cultural superstars like Yo-Yo Ma, and more. You can listen to Face Off, the US versus China, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me again. I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs. The next two episodes are set in the context of the breakdown of the bipolar ideological world and the redefinition of Australia's relations with its great and powerful friends for a new era. My hope is that both of these episodes will make you think about Australia's present-day identity and about the contemporary meaning of the US alliance. Now, these two episodes today is about new nationalism. The next is about new maturity. Follows on from what we learned in the previous episode. It's about Australia's realisation that it could no longer rely upon or shelter behind Britain, and even in many respects, the United States. And it's about its consequent re-evaluation of its great and powerful friends, and its attempts in the 1970s and 80s to accommodate itself to this changing reality. The next episode is going to be looking at how Australia, after the retreat of Britain and America from its region, initiated a policy of comprehensive engagement with Asia. An Asia which was now freed from Western imperialism and intervention, and which was determined to control its own affairs. So the three elements in today's episode follow from this. Namely, after first setting out the great changes which were transforming Australia's world, I'll deal with the way in which Australia reassessed its relations with Britain. Let's look at this reassessment. By the end of the 1960s, Australians were facing a future which was almost as challenging as that which they had faced at the end of the Second World War. All of their assumptions about the world and their ability to depend on great power protectors for their security were proving to be unsound. The simple ideological bipolar world of the early Cold War had lost much of its meaning. There was emerging in its place a multipolar world with perhaps five overlapping centres or poles. Russia and China had broken apart and were publicly brawling. The European Economic Community, which looked towards a European Federation, had become a separate centre of economic power. Japan had emerged as the second greatest economy in the world and therefore a potential world power in its own right. In addition, the Asian, African and Caribbean countries of the Third World refused to align themselves with the first, that is the West, or second, the East, worlds, and instead asserted their own interests both in the United Nations and elsewhere in the international arena. With their great influence over energy resources, OPEC, that is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, made up mostly of Third World countries, was also a force to be reckoned with. Now, the Soviet Union and the United States, especially with their increasing nuclear arsenals and delivery systems, still remained the military superpowers and the source of a possible cataclysmic conflict. But the simple structure of the ideological system, which had emerged out of the Second World War, had been substantially qualified. From Australia's perspective, the most important consequences associated with these changes were the withdrawal of Britain from Southeast Asia after the end of the Indonesian confrontation episode, and America's decision after its defeat in Vietnam to withdraw from the mainland of Asia and to reassess its alliance commitments. Britain from the early 1960s had recognised that it had no long-term role in the region. The military costs of supervising the liquidation of its last colonies had placed a great strain on its economy. Consequently, within a year of Indonesia's decision to cease harassing Malaysia, the British government made up its mind to depart the region, and by 1971, they were gone. As a parting gesture, they signed a five-power defence agreement with Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia and Singapore. It was intended to be a warning to Indonesia not to try again to upset this settlement of the problem of Britain's former colonies in Borneo. Under its terms, Australia agreed to station some limited forces in Malaysia. Yet though Australia did make this gesture, it was very uncertain whether it could look to Britain for assistance should Indonesia attempt a second time to assert its claims to these territories. Britain, simultaneously, had again applied for membership in the European Economic Community, the European Union. He was even more convinced that it had been a decade earlier that its future lay with Europe, not the wider British world. This time, Britain was accepted, and in 1973 it joined. Though the EEC had begun as a customs union, it had from the beginning planned in due course to become a federal state, and Britain had made its choice knowing what that portended. These British decisions had serious consequences for Australia. British military power would no longer help police Southeast Asia and keep it subservient to Western interests. Its power would not be available to help protect Australia in a time of crisis. Moreover, Australia had to pay a substantial price in trade terms for Britain's entry into Europe. Not only did Australia lose the markets protected by imperial tariff preferences, but it would have to compete in British markets against European products protected by the EEC's customs barrier. Most of all, these actions represented the death of a cultural idea that Australians were British, and that on that basis they should be able to share with all other Britons one mutually supportive policy in facing the world. Taken together, these changes represented a turning point for Australia in its relation to Britain, to Asia, and to itself. America's policy towards East Asia was similarly undergoing a great change. America's defeat in Vietnam at the hands of black pajama-clad peasants had been a great shock. The lesson that was most immediately learnt was the folly of assuming the role of international policeman in defending the so-called free world against communism at every point around the globe. The war had cost Americans dearly. They had taken heavy casualties, including 60,000 dead. Their economy was dangerously weakened, and the US dollar, which had, since the Second World War, been the standard international currency, collapsed. National morale had suffered a great blow. The answer of the Nixon administration was to abandon the worldwide crusade against communism. It withdrew American forces at the rate of 100,000 a year between 1969 and 1972. And in January 1973, it signed the Geneva Accords with the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, and so ended US participation in the war. Simultaneously, it reached accommodation with the People's Republic of China, supporting its claim to the China seat in the UN Security Council and looking towards establishing full diplomatic relations. It also sought détente, or a cooling of tensions, with the Soviet Union and negotiated treaties on nuclear arms limitation and territorial settlements in Europe. It seemed that in many respects the old ideological Cold War was at an end and was being replaced by power politics, the manoeuvring of great powers for favourable balances of power, remembering that a favourable balance of power is not a balance of power at all. Most directly affecting Australia, President Nixon, shortly after entering the White House on a trip to the Central Pacific, made it clear that the United States would never again become involved in a land war in Asia. According to this so-called Guam Doctrine of 1969, later badged as the Nixon Doctrine, the United States would in the future define its obligations under its alliances strictly in terms of its own interests. It would expect its allies,
except for the threat of a major power using nuclear weapons,
to take the prime responsibility for their own defence. Now, all of these dramatic reversals in American policy, the withdrawal from Vietnam, the overtures to communist China, and the declaration of the Guam Doctrine, had been taken without any consultation with Australia, without any seeming concern for the consequences of their decisions for Australia. What then was the ANZUS alliance to mean? Taken together, Australia's former strategic objective, namely that its great and powerful friends would keep Southeast Asia safe for the West, had failed at its first test. The great pillars of Australia's Cold War era policy had collapsed. Following President Johnson's April 1968 decision to scale down the war in Vietnam, Australia's Minister for the Air had confided to his diary, quote,
"To my mind, it's the first step of the Americans moving out of Southeast Asia, and that within a few years. There'll be no white faces on the Asian mainland."
The British and American withdrawal from the region required a fundamentally new approach to the region and the world. Both the Whitlam Labor government, which was elected to office in December 1972, and its successor, the Fraser Coalition government, which succeeded it in December 1975, accepted this necessity, and were in some major respects united on what had to be done in order to reshape Australia's foreign policy to meet its new international circumstances. The Whitlam government, coming to office in December 1972, was well fitted for this task, and it manufactured a set of new ideas and policies to meet the new times. Labor had been out of office during the high era of the Cold War, though it had broadly agreed with most of the Menzies government's policies in that period, except for the Vietnam War, and even in its initial stages, Labor had given its conditional support for American actions in Indochina. But being out of office, it did not carry with it any of the responsibility for the failed policies. It had been able very quickly, as the Vietnam War proved itself to be a disaster, to distance itself from the Cold War policies of the Conservatives. Labor's leader Gough Whitlam had a fresh mind and a powerful personality, and he used the opportunity to lead Australia in a new direction. Let's look then at the new nationalism and Australia's redefining of its relationship with Britain in this period. Now, it did take a little time for Australia to grasp the full implications of Britain's actions. Liberal Prime Minister John Gorton had begun the process when, after Holt's disappearance in the surf off Portsea in Victoria, he became Prime Minister, and Gorton was asked by the press whether, like Menzies, he was pro-British or, like Holt, pro-American. And Gorton declared himself to be simply pro-Australian. He'd gone on to call for an Australian nationalism, but he did not know what its content might be, apart from Australians being exclusively concerned with their own economic and strategic security. Reacting against the British and American retreat from the region, he dismissed forward defence as a viable policy and called for a fortress Australia. Now, in one way, Gough Whitlam was not the most likely leader to carry through a revolution in Australia's relationship with Britain. He came from the most anglicised section of the community. His father had been Solicitor General. He himself had been educated at Canberra Church of England Grammar School and had been in residence at St Paul's College in the University of Sydney while studying arts and law. He was deeply read in British constitutional law and British history. Indeed, just a few years before, while leader of the opposition, he was able to speak publicly and without any embarrassment of Australia as a
British state.
Nevertheless, he found the changed regional and global environment offered new opportunities for Australia. Whitlam had a keen sense of the possible, and by the 1970s he had come to believe that Australia's British white race patriotism was anachronistic. Britain's action in identifying its future with Europe had made Australia's previous ideas of loyalty and nationhood irrelevant. Australia had to find a new way of defining itself so that it could be accepted by a region now freed from Western imperialism, opposed to further intervention in its affairs, and determined to go its own Asian way. To this end, Whitlam instituted a range of measures to make Australia's policy and status more fitting for its future. Everything pushed in one direction, namely a new idea of nationality based on Australian citizenship rather than British nationality. Whitlam abolished the right of appeal from the Supreme Courts of the States to London's British Privy Council. He ended the award of imperial honours to Australian citizens, the OBEs, the MBEs and the KCMGs, which had given Australian British titles of knights or dames. In its place, he established an Australian system of honours, the Order of Australia. He removed the immigration and citizenship rights which British residents had always enjoyed. British migrants were placed on the same footing as all other migrants. They were no longer given preference in the allocation of assisted passages. They had to compete on the same basis with all other migrants for the right to be accepted. Their right to vote and participate in Australian political life became, as for all foreigners, dependent on their becoming Australian citizens. Australians were no longer described as British subjects on their passports. That change had been brought in by Harold Holt. They simply became Australian citizens. Furthermore, all remaining imperial preferences for British imports were abolished. Though Whitlam himself looked towards the coming of a republic, he was, after all, a classical scholar, he nevertheless recognised that the severing of ties to the monarchy would be at that time too divisive, and so he contented himself to changing the title of the Crown as it applied to Australia. And so the Queen became, for official Australian purposes, that is, when acting as head of state, the Queen of Australia. This placed Australia more on a level of equality with the United Kingdom as far as the monarchy was concerned, but it still left the monarch, the most central symbol of Britishness, as Australia's head of state. Perhaps the changes which affected most people were the symbolic ones, that is, those that touched areas of national identity. As early as 1964, Donald Horne, alerted by Britain's first application to enter the EEC, had in his seminal work, The Lucky Country, noted that there was what he called
A commendable emptiness in Australia about its place in the world, the need for a new rhetoric, a new approach, as if Australia were beginning again.
Some journalists and cultural gurus tried to fill this void by urging the creation of an exclusive Australian nationalism to make sense of these changes, and they described it as a new nationalism. They labelled all the severing of the ties with Britain in the Whitlam era as the harbinger of this new nationalism. Peter Weir and David Williamson's film, Gallipoli, like Breaker Morant, told stories of how British imperial authorities had treated Australian troops as colonials and sacrificed them as cannon fodder for British purposes. Historians wrote books entitled A Nation at Last, as though Australians had been involved in a great struggle for independence from 1788. But these did not address an eager public. Indeed, to call all the Whitlam changes new nationalism was something of a misnomer. These changes proceeded not from a great upsurge of national feeling. Rather, they were a practical response to British actions. In many cases, such as those affecting immigration, citizenship and trade, they were merely reciprocating for measures already taken by the British government against Australians or Australian trade. Indeed, new migrants from non-British countries were not told that instead of becoming good Britishers, they should become simply and only Australians. They were being encouraged to take pride in their past and to take their place in a multicultural Australia. That Australians had put mass nationalism behind them, or, to put it another way, that Australians no longer needed the intense identity of the mass nationalism era, was clear in how they responded to the search for an Australian national anthem to replace God Save the Queen. Committees were formed, competitions were held, entries were sought, but none of the lyrics commended themselves to the authorities or to the people. Commenting on this, the Australian newspaper said that Australian composers believed it's not time for a new national anthem, it's too late. Judith Wright, one of Australia's greatest poets, declared,
"It's an impossible task in the late 20th century to write a national anthem when we are starting to believe that nationalism has its limitations."
Peter Sculthorpe, a very eminent Australian composer, echoed these sentiments. He suspected that what the National Anthem Committee was seeking was a traditional style, stirring and heroic anthem. He said the
thought of that kind of anthem being written now is laughable. Society's changed too much.
But recognising that for official occasions and for sporting competitions, something had to be found, Australians in public opinion polls opted for the old and familiar colonial paean of praise for British Australia, namely Advance Australia Fair, with its words suitably adapted to the new times. Advance Australia Fair is not an anthem in the quasi-religious national sense. It does not evoke the kind of nationalist reverence that previous generations had felt for God Save the Queen. Indeed, both Gough Whitlam and his successor as Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, did not want Advance Australia Fair to be an anthem, just an Australian song. They personally preferred the folk ballad Waltzing Matilda to Advance Australia Fair. For both of these Prime Ministers then, nationalism, which had climaxed with imperialism and fascism in two great wars, was not something to be embraced, but something to be kept at arm's length, or limited, as Judith Wright put it. Moreover, the country did not want or need such a monolithic myth. Australia's search for a traditional national anthem of its own had come too late. Society had indeed changed too much. Australians were living in a post-national era. They had come to terms with modernisation, and they no longer felt the passionate need which had accompanied the disturbances of the great modernisation revolution for a monolithic identity. When Malcolm Fraser assumed office as Prime Minister, despite pressures from some of his supporters who could not bear to part with their British past, he endorsed the changes as part of Australia's inevitable adaptation to the new relationship with Britain. Indeed, he carried multiculturalism further than his predecessor and made it part of the new definition of Australia. Likewise, he was responsible for admitting the first great intake of Asian migrants after the abolition of the White Australia policy. And at the end of the Vietnam War, in recognition of Australia's responsibility to those that they had encouraged to fight, the Fraser government admitted almost 70,000 Indo-Chinese refugees, the highest proportion per capita of any country. In other words, the British rejection of Australia had met social changes in Australia which combined to produce a new way of being Australian, and it freed Australians from the thraldom of nationalism. So bear in mind, just in finishing, it took the Labor Party until the early 1990s to put republicanism on their platform. The great larrikin Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke had no urgency whatsoever in pushing Australia towards a republic. Indeed, he said that Australia's relationship with Britain was a story of peaceful and ungrudging disengagement. That's hardly the rallying cause for the Republicans. It took Labor Prime Minister Paul Keating to put this issue forcefully on the political agenda. He said that Australia becoming a republic would mean that Australia could be independent in ways that we've never been. Of course, Keating also wanted to change the flag. He wanted to remove the Union Jack from the corner of it. The American comedian Jerry Seinfeld, remember, once defined the Australian flag as Britain at night. But again, that change was not successful. And in 1999, under the Prime Ministership of John Howard, there was a vote for Australia to become a republic. The people rejected it. Australia is still a constitutional monarchy. And when John Howard talked about this issue at the Constitutional Convention at Parliament House in 1998, he said that the reason why they were gathered there was because of the changes to the British-Australian relationship in the last 30 years. But he said, in no way did those changes provide a compelling reason for constitutional change. So we are where we are. In the next episode, as foreshadowed, I'm going to look at this era and its effect on a new assessment of Australia's relations with the United States. Whitlam and Fraser brought in a new nationalism with Britain. It was Whitlam who brought in a new maturity with his relationship with Washington. Thank you. I'd also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today. And I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.